Molt bé. Tan bona. Amora. Mushroom kha. Naturone. Mushroom-me. Hola. Members, we have one very, very important exercise to deal with this morning. Apologies on behalf of our administration for confusion. I also said that here. It's a very important cornerstone of our work as a committee, as we do oversight over the executive. We've decided on this exercise so that we are able to be on top of the processes. Welcome members out of a weekend, I would imagine that was quite a fruitful so many things have happened over the weekend. It's 1 year on for government having been in place under the leadership of President Jacob Zuma. You also saw the confirmation by Shiloa for President of COPE. We also listened to Honorable Trollope on some of his expressions, representing, of course, the DA on a number of issues. I met him in Durban over the weekend. And welcome, Gigi. We only have one item, members, that we need to deal with, and it's very critical and very important. We must also appreciate work done by Honorable Carter. I see that she has found it her duty to assist this committee as far as much as she can. She has out of her own pocket, must mention this part, you know, bought a few books from UKZN that deal directly with some of our work here. I don't think that is supposed to be the case, members. I was just asking the committee secretariat for a budget that should really assist our committee with such research papers and research work. You know, there are periodicals that are being distributed monthly or weekly. You know, Farmers Weekly, Farmers Monthly publication. There are articles that are, that are circulated from time to time in media. To a point where I think we need to structure. We are 1 year on, even ourselves as a committee, almost to a point where we are to be expected, from a research point of view, we're going to follow on some of those articles that are in the media and perhaps place systems in place. Have systems in place that will assist us in the direction of being able to follow some of the activities, you know, that are taking place out there that impact directly on our work. We have with us Frank Jenkins. You know, at times I have to be quite sure, you know, from time to time I do keep on referring to him, talk about Tim Jenkins. You know, Tim Jenkins was also asking Frank as to whether he has any relations. Tim would have been one of those terrorists in the past, and also communist. But Frank is saying he has no relations at all, Dr. Postman. Just to be allayed your fears, so to speak, that we don't have an advocate Jenkins here who's harboring, you know, those tendencies, if they are tendencies at all. He has no relations. You're okay now. It would be so interesting if he did have, you know, just to what's enliven the debate and the discussion. The act assented on the 14th of April 2009, we do have it in front of ourselves, serves to provide for a procedure to amend money bills before Parliament and for norms and standards for amending money bills before provincial legislatures and related matters. That's what the Act is about. We had asked Advocate Jenkins to take us through the Act. We are in the space of agriculture, horticulture, and fisheries. So the Act is to be relevant to our area of work. And whatever issues that we are free to engage. Of course, Advocate Jenkins may not be knowing the finer details as they relate to our work, but as they relate to the Act itself, he has been assisting in the drafting within the Finance Committee as of year before last and last year. In fact, this does not even date back to 2 years ago. It's been an ongoing process, you know, for as long as it's been around, I would imagine. I certainly caught up with it 2 years or 2.5 years ago or so. But you give us the background as well. It is as important as we are doing our own daily work. Because at the end of the day, when this budget is brought to us, we have to make a meaningful contribution also in terms of our own work in relation to amending the budget itself. That's the importance. That's equally the importance of a committee of parliament. Unlike before, today going forward, we have such a duty among us to exercise, perform, so to speak. The DG felt it important that he joined, I would imagine, also for his own sake within the department, that he gets a sense as to what the Money Bills Act is saying. It relates to his own work as an executing officer in charge within the department. Members, without really waste of time, I did apologize for confusion on behalf of the administration that were meant to have been here, then later on the message took us outside. I can understand why she did that. It is because our next meeting is going to be at M46. I would imagine she had confused it in that direction. Members, if there are no other issues, I know for a fact that we are fond of engaging all the time. But I would imagine these ones are straightforward, and then we'll engage with Advocate Jenkins. Thank you.
Morning. Honorable Member, Chairperson, thank you for that, and the guest. The sound is okay? Everybody can hear me? Fine.
A bit louder.
Fine, so maybe I must try this one. How's that? That's true. The Moneyball's Amendment Procedure and Related Matter Act. Maybe I must, there's a handout given. I don't know if the handout includes the notes. It doesn't include the notes I can see here. From here, what needs to be done is to print this document, if one has it electronically. One looks at the left-hand corner of the screen, there's a thing called print what. There's a little thing in there. One must say print the notes. And you'll get a narrative of this act. It's included in the electronic copy that I've distributed. But that, in any case, won't go up on the overhead projector. I prefer to work from the paper because I feel there's more interactive engagement then. Why mentioning this, that the notes are there, is just so that if committee members have questions or want to learn more about the Act, a lot has been said in those notes. So one must just try and print those notes and then read it, and one can then understand what's happening there. Just shortly, just where this Act's coming from. Look, I'm not familiar with what the members here are familiar with in terms of this Act. What do you know about the Act? What do you want to know? Where's the gap that we need to fill? My experience so far is that it's not the information about the Act, the knowledge about this Act has not thoroughly been absorbed by members of Parliament and by committees of Parliament and by Parliament itself. It's a very new procedure. I think that's just a matter of fact. The countries that I've looked at when we were drafting this Act, and I'll get to why we drafted it, but the countries we looked at when we were drafting it had a similar process that they've gone through. I think the best example to look at is Canada, who passed their, what's called their Accountability Act in 2006, which establishes this function of a budget office, which will then assist the Parliament to amend money bills. It took 2 years for them to really get to grips with that Act and how to fulfill those functions, and they in fact still getting to grips with it. The reason why we have this Act, Chair, may I just quickly pause here? I don't want to take too much of your time this morning. What kind of grace do I have for this presentation? How long can I take?
Be here until 12.
Let me put it then to you, Chair, through you, that if it gets maybe a bit long-winded or maybe irrelevant, just ask me to get back to the grits of the Act, because there's a lot that one can say about this Act. But I'll proceed then and see how we go with it. The background to the Act, as you are aware, that there are two core functions of Parliament. One is legislation, making laws, and the other one is to maintain oversight of the executive or the exercise of national executive authority, which means we're looking at what the executive is doing, and we evaluate that against the legislation that's out there, against the policies that's been adopted, and to see whether they are performing the way they should be performing. So within that realm, within those two core functions, Parliament from 1999 said that we need to structure our oversight function. We need to get to grips with it, what does it mean, and how are we going to do it. The issue of passing laws are spelled out in the Constitution. We know how to pass laws. We've made rules, etc., etc. But the question of oversight is left a little bit unstructured. So there was a Parliament commissioned some research to be done in 1999 and eventually led to a report to the joint rules. And there was another task team established to look at how we're going to implement these recommendations in the report. It led to what was called the Task Team on Oversight and Accountability, which then eventually led to a report that was adopted by the Joint Rules Committee and the two houses in 2009, just before the elections, which is called the Oversight and Accountability Model for Parliament. Now, part of this Oversight and Accountability Model, this model itself looks at various parts. It looks at your constitutional landscape, what is it that the Constitution requires, then looks at what are the institutional mechanisms Parliament is using, for instance, committees, to maintain oversight or to exercise oversight. And what is needed in committees to make our oversight more effective? Strengthening the committee, beefing up its research capacity, etc., etc. That's contained in there. Makes interesting reading. And then another part was the budget process. Because it was argued and it was then accepted that the budget process, the budget itself of a country, is of course a policy instrument. It's an instrument prioritizing certain policies, what should be then implemented in the short term and then also in the medium term. Medium term meaning the three-year expenditure framework, looking at what we're going to do, the estimates of the next 3 years, so that we can have some predictability there. And within this research on the budget function of Parliament, the Oversight and Accountability Model made certain recommendations on what is then defined in the Constitution, Section 77.3, that Parliament must have an act that sets down the procedure how to amend money bills. Okay, so that's just where the idea is coming from to have this, the reason why the Act is what it is today. I want to just take a step sideways now from where the Constitution says we need a money, national piece of legislation to amend money bills. When one looks at the Constitution, the issue of policy formulation rests with the executive authority. In other words, Cabinet makes policy. Parliament can look at it, can comment on it, but Parliament, in effect, doesn't make policy. We make laws to implement that policy. And there's a debate, it's a discussion between laws and legislation, how it works. In any case. Beyond that executive function of making policy, Parliament can introduce its own legislation, but the executive can also introduce legislation, of course, except money bills. Constitution is pretty straightforward. A money bill, that's a bill that appropriates money, or it takes your money, taxation laws. Puts on levies, like on alcohol and on cigarettes, puts levies on petrol. All of these functions, to give and to take money, is a specific function that rests with the member of cabinet responsible for financial matters, in other words, the Minister of Finance. Parliament cannot introduce a money bill. Parliament can amend any bill that's been introduced, of course, except when we read Section 77.3, the Constitution wants us to have a procedure set out in legislation how we're going to amend such a bill. The other procedures how to amend legislation is taken up in our rules, and we can amend it. And as you're aware, we can even suspend those rules according to whatever. If we are in a hurry to pass the law, certain procedural steps can be suspended. So then, these two come together, these two issues I've just spoke about, in the Oversight and Accountability Report. It's said we need a structured oversight process that is actually aligned to the budget process, and that is what Section 77.3 also has in mind when we must pass legislation. That legislation must be connected to our oversight function. If I want to put the other side of the argument there, that procedure in Section 77.3 cannot really be connected to a legislative function because the Constitution spells out the legislative function clearly. In other words, the issues of majorities. How do you? What kind of majorities do you need to pass a money bill in a NCOP? What's the procedure to pass a money bill? It doesn't help to rewrite all of those again in the piece of legislation. So we wanted an additional procedure to what the Constitution sets out. You know, a money bill passes the same way as a normal Section 75 bill. There's an ordinary majority in the National Assembly that's needed to pass the legislation. Of course, there must be a quorum. And then in the NCOP, the delegates vote per delegate and not per province. And you cannot, with a piece of legislation, change that. So it's not the legislative function that's applicable here, but the oversight function. So therefore, this Act came out, and the Act applies basically to the whole budget process. It focuses on amendments to all money bills, but it also includes procedures for your medium-term budget policy statement, and includes procedures for your division of revenue bill. A division of revenue bill in my opinion, is a money bill, but the Constitution defines it as a 76 bill, which means it passes the same way through the NA, but in the NCOP one is voting per province, and you need a provincial mandate to pass the Division of Revenue Bill. So that's the background, just roughly, Chairperson, on the Act. When one now starts looking at the Act, and I've said it, it applies to the whole budget process, I want to break up the presentation into two parts. One, just talking sort of about this critical foundation of the Act, the oversight function of Parliament, and how that gives rise to amendments to the budget of a department. And then the second part, I want to focus on the procedures within the Act. How are we going to actually amend those budgets? Now, the second part is really connected to the whole budget process, the introduction of the budget, etc., etc. So it might be fly over certain detail there. And if you want more detail, please feel free to interrupt me and I can stop there and talk more about it. Okay, let's start with the oversight function of Parliament. The oversight cycle, in terms of this Act, starts with what is called the Budgetary Review and Recommendation Report. Now, this is a report that assesses, and if I can refer you to a page that describes this, one can look at page 3, read with page 4, Budgetary Review and Recommendation Report. The Act requires that every committee of the National Assembly annually assess page 3 and 4.
Some are they fell up because they're numbered.
One looks at the Act, the Budgetary Review and Recommendation Report, section 4, section 5 of the Act, let me make sure, section 5. Section 5 of the Act, that's on page 6, but depends again what kind of version of the Act one has.
Can you just tell us what the headline is of the particular page? That will help us all. This one, I think, is Budgetary Review and Recommendation.
Yes. One can look at the previous page as well, Honorable Abrams, on page 3, which is context. The Budgetary Review and Recommendation Report is a requirement that National Assembly committees annually assess each department, and then it sets out what the committee report must contain and on what it must be based. And when one looks at what it must be based on, the information that the committee must scrutinize is your prevailing strategic plans, which was introduced, of course, with that year's budget with the appropriation bill. So one looks at the prevailing strategic plans. One would also look at the medium-term estimates, if those are available then. One can look at reports from Parliament. One thinks here of the Committee on Public Accounts reports of the department that's been scrutinized. The report on actual expenditure, there was Section 32 reports, that's Section 32 of the Public Finance Management Act. What the committee will do is they will look at these different reports and then assess the department whether the department performed given its available resources. Now, all the time one must keep in mind that this is not a review of the policy that's applicable to the department. It's not to say, Parliament cannot say, well, we think the policy needs to be broadened here or there, but when one assesses the performance of a department, it is really looking at what the department set out to do and that available resources it wanted, and then to make a conclusion on that. The Act says here a committee can make recommendations then for the forward use of resources. And this is the first taste of what we see in this Act, in that the Act is trying to establish this oversight cycle and is trying to create the culture, or creates the legal norms, really, that when one wants to amend the budget of the executive, or really budget of the country, or then the specific vote of a department, we are looking forward all the time. It cannot happen in isolation to the history, in other words. So it is really looking at how the department has performed, what it has done, and then saying, in the future, we want you to do the following, Should you not do the following, we will then change your budget so that we can ensure that our oversight function actually has peace, so that we can ensure that our oversight function creates value for the country. That is the main message that I want to bring today, in fact, is that that is how one thinks of amending the budget in terms of this act. This report, of course, goes to the House. Once the House have adopted the report, it includes then recommendations on the forward use of resources. It is sent to the Minister of Finance and to the relevant member of Cabinet to say, this is what we think your department is up to. You're good, you're bad, you're too good, you're too bad, you're ugly, whatever. So you send it on and they get a sense then, and I'm going to come back to this part because it's a very important point, this communication, this bridge that is now being built between the executive and the legislature. Well, there's always been a bridge in our system of government, but we're doing this specific communication of the executive on the budget issue. The second part of the oversight function involves the medium-term budget policy statement. Now, the medium-term budget policy statement it consists of many parts, but critical in that part is basically a review. If one looks at the narrative of it, it's an indication of what we can expect next year. We've looked at the first 6 months of this year, keeping in mind that South Africa works on a medium-term estimation program, or however you must put it. I'm not from the Treasury, but it means that we are always busy with a three-year cycle in the budget. We're always forward-looking, estimating what we're going to earn and what we're going to spend in the next 3 years and making plans for that. Now, when you table the medium-term budget policy statement, part of it is saying this is how we've done, and remember that is tabled in October, end of October. So we have the first 6 months of the financial year. We look back, how did it go in that first 6 months of financial year? Actual expenditure and actual revenue, what did we really get? What did we really do with it? How does that relate to what we thought of in terms of the estimates of this 3 year? And now what we can now do with the medium-term budget policy is correct some of those estimates and give a better account of what we can expect in the next financial year when that is introduced. February, but it starts 1 April. Okay, so this document then lands in Parliament, and it contains certain aspects, and this act then clearly states what we want the Minister of Finance to include in that MTBPS, Medium-Term Budget Policy Statement. One, we want to include there a rolling three-year fiscal framework. Fiscal framework. Fiscal framework is everything. It is what we get and what we spend. Everything what we get is your tax that we collect, the interest we earn on investments, it's the money that we go and borrow at commercial and other international banks. And everything we spend is what we spend on all government programs, and it also includes the cost of borrowing. So it's everything that comes in and everything that comes out. And usually this is defined as a budget surplus or as a budget deficit. So that's a very important, actually, aggregation that we keep in mind. You know, is our expenditure more than what we're receiving? In other words, we're going to have to go out and borrow more money somewhere. Or do we have a surplus? In other words, we've got additional money that we can then spend on something else or invest. This must be in the MTBPS. There's other parts of the MTBPS as well. For instance, your spending priorities of government, what it wants to prioritize in the next financial year, what we can expect are going to be the priorities. The information before the portfolio committee is, of course, vital because one can see then what are the priorities that the department wants to look at and then start with the strategic thinking in the committee of how we're going to maintain oversight over those priorities that the department has identified. Other inclusions in the MTBPS is your estimations for your next year's division of revenue and the year thereafter, 2 years after, and as well your any kind of amendments that will come from your conditional grant allocations to provinces and local governments. So it's a collection of various documents, and these documents, in table, must be referred to committees. These committees are pursuant to the Act established by the Houses. But the Act requires that each House establishes a Committee on Finance and a Committee on Appropriations. These are instruments that are then used in this Act for the procedure. So, it's the first time they come up now, so I'm mentioning them now. They're in Section 4 of the Act. If one looks at page 6, headed parliamentary mechanisms and as well as functions, the next page, page 7 of mine, one sees, gets some information about these committees, what their functions are and so on. But the functions will come apparent as we go on with the presentation. So what we have then in the committees of finance, there's a specific mandate for them to look at policy issues, to look at the revenue issues, to look at fiscal issues. So this rolling three-year fiscal framework and the spending priorities then refer to committees on finance of the two houses. The issues of division of revenue and your actual revenue, not actual revenue and expenditure, but your conditional grant allocations, those will go to your committees on appropriations. So they will then have a look at what we can expect in the division of revenue over the next few years. Not relevant too much for this committee, but we can see that there's a role to be played here by the NCOP, clearly in consultation with the provinces, because we're talking about the proposed division of revenue. But that's something that needs to be developed as we grow into the Act. Now, looking at this, the committees must then come up with a report on this fiscal framework, which is a very interesting thing. It's not something Parliament has done in the past. And the report can indicate whether the fiscal framework in the view of Parliament is appropriate. Now, what do I mean by that? We know that we're working with a budget deficit at the moment. In other words, we're spending more than we're earning because of the international financial crisis. If one looks at the budget that was introduced this year, one can see how that deficit is going to grow to about 11%. Now, what Parliament will have to do is make a comment on whether that's appropriate or not. And whether it's appropriate or reasonable or not, of course, depends on the context where we're in. When one looks at the European Union, they set a target for 3%. In fact, not a target, it's a legislative requirement. You cannot have a budget deficit more than 3%. But that is clearly not appropriate for a developing economy. Budget deficit in America is much bigger, as well as in Japan, but they have different economies. They're much more flexible, they're much bigger. So one needs their specialized advice. And this is not something that this committee will do, but it's important just to know the procedures and all the aspects of the Act, I think. But this specialized advice will come from the Parliamentary Budget Office. And that's something we'll talk about later. That's in Section 15 of the Act. And it's a specialized unit that's created to give this kind of advice on the fiscal issues, as well as other issues of estimates and so on. But for the purpose of today, I think it's important to know that the committees on finance can actually make recommendations to the House about whether the fiscal framework is appropriate or not. And the committees on appropriations can make recommendations on whether the proposed division of revenue is appropriate or not. And these reports, once adopted by the House, is then sent to the Minister of Finance. The Act spells out time frames. The important one, and it should be able to be implemented even this year, is that for the budgetary review and recommendation report, these must be finalized between the adoption of the appropriation bill, which is usually June or July, and before the adoption of the reports on the MTBPS, which is usually end of November. So during this period, but in looking at the Act and trying to work out mechanisms how to implement it, we're looking at portfolio committee submitting these assessments of government departments before the end of October at least. So that might become a little bit tight, Honourable Chair, because the annual report only gets to you beginning of October, and you really need to look at those annual reports. So we might try and squeeze the departments to give it to us sooner. I don't know how we're going to do that. But the annual reports will play a critical role in looking at the performance of that department, because it's the very previous financial year's annual report that the committee will look at. But it certainly brings forward the question to say we cannot really accept late submission of annual reports unless there's a good reason for it. So that's something that Parliament and the Executive will have to discuss. The time frame for the MTBPS procedure is 30 days. As I say, it's not that important for this committee, but it's a very short time frame. I think it's too short. I think we will have to look at this. And there's in implementing this act, there's a team consisting of both politicians and administrators looking at the implementation of this team, of this act, and advising the presiding officers. In the end, it will have to go through the whips and through the joint rules to get mechanisms in place to have this act functioning properly or the way it's intended to. And at that level where I'm talking about, so we think that 30 days for the NCBPS to have a proper discussion around the NCBPS might be too short. We might have to look at that and change that a little bit. Chair, I would like to now move over to the second part. Keeping in mind that we've sent reports on the annual assessment of departments to the various ministers, as well as annual reports on the projected proposed division of revenue and the projected fiscal framework for the next year. Okay, so what the Act then goes and says that when you then introduce the budget, you need to respond to these issues. You need the Minister of Finance. Sorry, there's a hand. Honourable Chair.
To be clarified further before passing to the next session. Advocate Jackson, are you saying within the 30 days that you are mentioning, the participation of chairpersons should have taken place? Public hearings should have taken place? The provinces and local government should have been consulted? And the appropriation committee should have come back to Parliament to come and present the report that they would have compiled within those 30 days. Is it what you are referring to?
I'm referring to the MCBPS. I'm not sure where you're reading from in the Act.
I'm reading from passing the division of revenue.
No, I'm not there. That's still coming. What I'm talking about is the MCBPS, that's Section 6 of the Act. But it doesn't change the answer. I'm saying that, yes, within 30 days. There's no specific requirement for public hearings, but the Constitution requires Parliament to facilitate public involvement in all its processes. So there must be some kind of public involvement. Meaningful public involvement, like they expected Parliament to do in courts. I mean, we can't just have a pro forma exercise. It must be meaningful public participation. And yes, if one looks at, you're talking about the interaction between committees. If one looks at Section 6.2F, it says that part of this NCBPS is a review of actual expenditure and actual revenue of each national department. Or actual spending, more like it. And that involves, in my view, portfolio committees. Now, this is something that has long been coming on, that portfolio committees also have to look at the expenditure patterns of the department they oversee. And that one must get in the Government Gazette, because the Treasury publish on a monthly basis the expenditure of government departments. I mean, one can also just, with the power given to Parliament, request the department to submit that. I mean, we can request the department just to send a copy of its actual expenditure to the portfolio committee to look at it and to see what the pattern is there and how that relates to the budget and the planning behind it. But that used to be done by what was called the Joint Budget Committee. The Joint Budget Committee has now been replaced by these other four committees, the two Appropriation and two Finance Committees, in a different form. But even at the Joint Budget Committee level, when it was still around, there was a need for portfolio committees to get involved. So that, I'm trying to say, there should be some consultation between the portfolio committees and your committees on appropriations and committees on finance. Just to give some indication to the committee on finance, you know, what does the portfolio committee think of the way this money has been spent? Because what the committee on finance will have to do is get all these inputs from the different committees. And then look at the fiscal framework, which is that big umbrella that I spoke about, and say, well, do we need more money or do we need less money? If we need less money, we can cut that deficit a little bit. If we need more, we're going to have to borrow more money, unless there's a surplus. But I don't think we're going to return to a surplus within the next 4 or 5 years. So that's what I'm saying. In that period, I think is very short. We'll have to do extremely good planning for that. Remember, 30 days, in terms of the Act, means 30 working days, 30 parliamentary working days. But when you say parliamentary working days, the question comes up, but what about constituency days? Is that a parliamentary day? In terms of the law, it's a parliamentary day. We still have an ATC on that day. We still do parliamentary business. Except there's no plenary, there's no committees. So we need to clarify these issues a little bit. What do we mean by day? And if we then get a good, the Act says a day is a parliamentary working day, doesn't include public holidays and weekends, or recess periods. But constituency work is not recess. So there maybe we need to change the definition in the rules to say, but those are recess in our view. You know, because Parliament itself, the warm bodies are not operating then. But the easiest would be to try and look at those time frames and try and change them a little bit.
Why don't we do it the following way, members? Let's allow Advocate Jenkins and maybe take notes. What we might also wish to do, because the line is very thin on the money bills presentation and also on the budget cycle, which is very much bordering on the issues that you want to raise, Mama. To a point where I've made a note here, because ideally that is also what we would have wanted to do from day one when we come to this institution called Parliament, so that we, as we do our oversight work, we have a sense as to what is that cycle. So that cycle can be very vicious in the sense that it's literally one after the other, leaving very little space, if not room, for us to maneuver within. This annual report, which basically gives you a sense as to what happened in terms of implementation of the past program, there is almost immediately your strat plan, and there is your budget. And there is also your MTBPP, medium-term budget policy statement. Now, these are processes that can be very complex in their own right. As we do our oversight work, we need to keep tabs with all these processes so that we are not lost in the process. We are able to predict in the next few months, we will be expected to receive, you know, the plan. And how do they link with the whole chain or with the whole cycle? What I want us to do, of course, Advocate Jenkins will inadvertently be touching on some of those issues, but we also run a risk of engaging on them. I want us not to engage. Yeah, but we shouldn't engage on these budgetary issues for now. Granted, they are very tightly linked, but I want us to focus more on that money bills issue, because there's a lot involved. Otherwise, we'll miss out on those critical but complex issues on the money bills. Whilst we pack issues on the budgetary, you know, cycle processes. So that's what I would, appeal to all of us. Otherwise, we can get lost in the process. I would appeal on that one. But the process, in fact, to a point where I would want us to engage, you know, National Treasury to take us through also this whole budget cycle after this exercise. Because on its own as well, it has its own intricacies and that whole cycle, which is equally very important for our own oversight work as we engage with the department and agencies.
My apology. You see, there are certain things that you need to be clarified before proceeding, because if you are not clarified while it's presenting, you seem not to follow properly. That's why I felt personally that I need to be clarified before proceeding. Because I was far from where he was. So that's why sometimes. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Both very pertinent issues for both this presentation and understanding this act. I mean, one is one must look at it holistically to see the whole picture, because it is a complicated thing, and we're going to struggle. We, as Parliament, both administration and the politicians, are going to be challenged in the next few years to get this thing working properly, because it's a new procedure and it changes the way we've been operating. That was the one that just came out. The other part is what the Honourable Chair now said about the budget process outside Parliament. What's happening there? Remember, what we've done now up to this level, before I took the jump, is that we've now given Parliament's views on the performance of government departments, as well as perhaps a recommendation on how to use the resources in the future. And then we've also given a view to the Minister on what we think of the fiscal position of the country, whether the deficit and surplus is appropriate for us, and whether the division of revenue between national, provincial and local spheres of government is appropriate. This happens maybe middle November, end of November. Minister needs to respond to these things when the budget is introduced in February, middle February. So between those two dates, middle November to middle February, if the minister wants to be integrated and understand, and if the system works properly, the minister must take these recommendations from Parliament and work it into the budget process of the various departments and of the country and as a whole. So that's a very complicated process. So there's quite a lot of work during that festive season, and that's expected from National Treasury. Of course, they can say, well, we do not want to comply with these recommendations, and then we Parliament can effect those changes itself to the budget. And this is where we're getting now, where when that budget is introduced. Chair,
thank you, Chairman. I was a bit unclear on what you tried to convey to us on this oversight cycles, but what I do recognize is that these quarterly reports that we can ask, or they should give us, would be a good thing if we could dig our teeth into that on a routine matter, as a routine, because what's the use of coming every year and have another budget passed? And the cycle of setting things right is a year cycle. I mean, there's no business out there that is run on a yearly basis. It's monthly reports for certain things, it's quarterly reports, it's half-year reports. It's the only way you can run a business. And that's with business people that's trained for it, and people that's very hands-on different levels in their business. Now, government is getting to be a very complicated business itself. So I think we should really go on this money bill, what they're asking. If it is required for us to look at it quarterly, we should do it. Because that would also make it easier for the DG, because he's going to know what is expected of him. And there's not a whole pot of problems falling on his head at the end of the year when we are unsatisfied. It's better to criticize on a quarterly basis and help the department to get straightened out. That's my point of view. So I don't know whether I missed you there, but that's clear how I see it. So I don't know if the advocate would want to comment on this, because that's the way I see it.
Member, can I appeal that we allow Advocate Jenkins to proceed with the presentation of the money bill? Can we take notes on some of the areas that were not clarified on? And then run up until 10 to quarter to 11, according to that watch. We engage with the presentation thereafter. How does it sound? Thanks.
Thank you for that, Chair. We're now in the budget process. The Minister has come to the House middle February, stable, the budget. Okay, now a budget consists in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, in terms of the Constitution, of course, on the annual national budget, and includes revenue proposals. Now, what this act requires in addition to that is not just the different departmental votes, but the act requires that the fiscal framework for that year is now introduced, a formal fiscal framework, as well as the medium term, the next 2 years of fiscal framework. And Parliament will deal with that separately, or specifically, I should say. Look at that fiscal framework, and I can say again that your total revenue and your total expenditure balanced off to understand whether the country is running at a deficit. We need more money, we need to borrow more money, or raise taxes in the medium term, or whether we're running at the surplus. In other words, we can actually spend more or invest more. So this is then put before the House. That fiscal framework, and I want to now just highlight once again that this Act is trying to channel. If one looks at the on my page 8 and 9, it's says fiscal discipline, procedural rails, fiscal discipline, principled rails. What I mean by rails is almost this, the tracks of a train. You know, this act is trying to give that kind of direction to Parliament, to define its mandate, I could say. So, first, it uses certain mechanisms to define Parliament's mandate there. Now, there's two ways which this act does it. The most important one is it's specific principles that it lays down, and I want to get to that in a moment. First, I want to look at this procedural mechanisms or procedural rails. And that means that there's a certain sequencing envisaged in the Act, and it starts with Parliament consideration and adoption of the fiscal framework that's presented with the national budget. That total picture, once Parliament has adopted that, and that the committee involved there would be the two committees on finance. And then they will look at it. They can make certain suggestions to that fiscal framework. Should they have, of course, the backing of history? Should they, of course, have those reports on the MTBPS saying, we want to change this fiscal framework when it comes to us? It's a very critical and important step. And changing the fiscal framework is a very involved, very complicated task, in my view. But once that has been done, once Parliament has accepted that we are going to be operating at a budget deficit or a surplus at a certain level, then that cannot change in terms of this Act. In other words, any decision taken beyond that must comply with that fiscal framework. In other words, you can't give a department more money if there isn't more money to give in the whole, in the purse, in the fiscal. If it means we have to borrow more money and change those aggregates in the fiscal framework, it would be falling outside the mandate of this Act. So that's very important. And once that's done, one moves to the second part, and that's the division of revenue. How that total package is now going to be divided between national, provincial, and local. Once the division of revenue has been adopted, Parliament can go over and look at the appropriation bill. And that is, of course, just that section of the Division of Revenue Bill, which is the national. And then any amendment there must comply with both your Division of Revenue. In other words, you can't go and try and amend the appropriation bill to get money that was given to provinces back into the national sphere. So you can only stick it. Once we say that national government gets X amount, any amendments to the appropriation must still comply with that. So it tries to enforce what's, in my view, logical. You've adopted the total picture, you've divided that between the three spheres, and when you're looking at your specific sphere, you have to stick with that. And you can amend things in between there. You can't fundamentally change the total amounts, but you can amend in between. And that sort of directs Parliament to maintain its oversight function and not get involved with issues of policy too much. Although that line is so thin, but I don't think we should go into that. That's a whole discussion on its own. But that's what I mean in the presentation on procedural rails. It places Parliament in that track, as a train would go. You can choose at which stations you want to stop, but we cannot get off that track. So just to get back to the budget procedure, we've now looked at the fiscal framework. And how do we look at that fiscal framework? The Act then requires, if one looks at page 9, heading is fiscal discipline principle rails. I discussed two sections of the Act there. The most important one is section 8.5, and I also discussed section 11.3. Section 8.5 has to do with all decisions taken in terms of the Act. Okay, and it says that all decisions taken in terms of the Act must comply with certain principles, and those principles are broadly stated, and they all have to do with some type of reasonableness in the decision making. So we're trying to get away from sort of arbitrary ad hoc decisions and have to place everything within a context. If I can look at section 8.5, you can see there, when taking any decision, Parliament must ensure that there's an appropriate balance between revenue, expenditure and borrowing. Now that just goes straight into what is appropriate in terms of the specific fiscal position. Okay. Ensure that debt levels and debt interest costs are reasonable. Now debt levels to be reasonable, that's another aggregate. There's two aggregates that I think all committees and members will have to start working with when we implement this Act. One is budget surplus or a budget deficit, and what's appropriate. In other words, in European Union, a budget deficit of 3% is fine. Budget deficit of 10% is not fine. Okay. Budget deficit of 11 or 12% in Greece was seen as completely disproportionate to the rest of European Union. Budget deficit in South Africa of 11% is fine. It's compared to, when we compare it to India and Brazil, it's reasonable. It's in line with our state of economy and the type of economy we have. That's the one aggregate one we'll have to get used to. I'm just mentioning it. I'm not trying to really imprint anything. The other aggregate, which will be very important, is your debt ratio to your gross domestic product. And that's very much in the news now with Greece. The gross domestic product is what we make in the country. That's already a complicated way of determining your gross domestic product or your gross national product. But it's basically what we produce as a country. What's our output? This is how big we are. We make so much a year. Now, debt is usually a percentage of that. That's the national debt that we borrow. Here, South Africa is at about 30%, which is fine. It's actually much better. It's better than Japan, it's better than America, it's better than the United Kingdom. But they have different economies, so they can absorb bigger debt burdens. Greece has 120 or 114%, which means they owe much more money than they actually produce. So they're on a spiral, downward spiral. That's why we see this concern in the European Union around this. So, okay, there's a hand, should I?
Sorry, I was also trying to follow the pages as well on this.
I'm on the presentation, sir, but if one looks at section 8.5, I'm discussing just some of those concepts.
No, the X has got 2, 4, 6, and so on.
Yeah. That would be page 10 of the Act.
What I'm saying, Advocate Jenkins, we are on even numbers on the.
Yes.
Is that how it is?
Yeah. Yes. I think the other side would be a translation, would be the second language.
Oh, okay. Sorry,
Mr. Yeah, on the point that the advocate made on the debt ratio to gross domestic product, the total debt, is it now state debt or country's debt? Because gross domestic product then is obviously all private and state expenses. How do we see to this?
Yeah. Thanks. The budget office is going to help you with that. That's an economist's thing. I mean, what I've read about it, and I've read quite a bit on it, but the gross domestic product itself is a complicated thing, and there's three or four different ways of determining it. One excludes, one is just what government actually puts in, looking at the actuarial values, how that money should have increased, and then they make a projection of what we should put out. And there's another one that takes into account everything that private business also puts in there. But what the GDP to debt ratio is, the way I understand it, is taking the simplest forms. They're looking at your GDP, what government puts in, to say, then project that as an output, and then looking at government bonds that have been issued. And that's how government gets debt. We issue a bond against the international one. And that is your government debt, in other words, not private debt. But there's a connection, of course, because the Reserve Bank is borrowing that money to commercial banks, is borrowing it to other people to make the economy tick. But it's really something for the budget office. It's also something just for the finance committees. They will look at these things. And I'm sure they have an easier way to explain it and to actually make sense of it. But what I'm trying to do is actually just looking at issues happening in the news and in the media at this point in time and pointing that out to members, because I'm doing these workshops for a while so that they can maybe familiarize themselves with the concept by looking at what's happening out there, seeing what's on the news. When they're talking about the problem in Greece, what are they talking about? And then can we understand it? Can we understand what's happening in South Africa? Because that all has to be internalized in the end within this institution to fulfill that oversight function. But it's something that's going to happen at the finance committee level, this exercise of the fiscal framework.
The other challenge that we're going to be confronted with members is that Aggregate Jenkins is a legal fundi. Whether or not we should really expect so much on some of the financing issues, it's another issue that we might also wish to carry at the back of our mind. Whilst by right he has every reason to be knowledgeable about anything, whether or not he will be able to speak with authority on these other issues. That's why I was asking and appealing earlier on that maybe we should allow him just on the legal side of things. Of course, himself, he does go overboard at times in trying to be liberal in really getting to feed us with other, details. But he is naturally going to be limited. You still want to add something, Mr. Chair?
Yes, I think, Mr. Chairman, the advocate has mentioned a very, very important point here. I don't think we should underestimate the importance of this committee as when it comes to financial matters or matters of the economy, because we know what the basis of this economy is. It is agriculture. To a large extent. If that part of the economy would take a big knock, we have a big problem. And what has happened overseas now is between the lines, if you read between the lines, it is of great danger to us as well. I mean, if you take a country, an established country like Greece, that is in such a problem, they have now been bailed out by the bigger brothers and sisters of that family. But if you watch the news last night, and I watched a variety of news channels, because not all of them give the same idea, they're also covering up and appeasing people. They are now worried about Portugal, Spain, and other countries, other smaller brothers, less stronger brothers of that family, is now also in a mess. And they're talking about devaluation of the euro, which, if our rand remain strong, it puts us in a worse situation on export. So don't think that what's going on in Europe and the fact that they're taking a knock from the Iceland volcano, that doesn't matter. The other matter is that we've seen now yesterday over the weekend that for the first time Allied troops has marched with former Soviet republics. That is a message that they're sending out to the rest of the world, that Europe is now, through this economy, that they've taken a knock, a serious knock. They are now forming strategic partnerships in those governments. I expect NATO and the former Soviet Union states to be some form of integration. I expect it. Because this marching together of people is just sending a message out to their people to get used to it. It's a good propaganda, window. So we must not underestimate what's going on there. they're going to look after their houses first. And we must learn from that. And that is why I say we must not underestimate the importance of what this committee and other committees must do when we look at the way that our government on the state is spending money. We need to bring in our expertise into this committee. Whether we tap it from the expertise of organized agriculture, but the fact is that we have to bring it into this committee. We cannot say, okay, we're not economists, we're not lawyers, we're not this, we're not that. We have to bring it into here. We have to make it part of the debate. Because if anything, we are not in a position, if we take the Greece knock, we don't have bigger brothers in Africa. We are the big brother. So we have to be the strongest in Africa, so we cannot afford to make the mistakes that has been made in Europe.
Okay, thank you. We should also not undermine the fact that, you know, we have more input, I think, more on the money bills that... You are also almost right in saying, let's also get the expertise from organized labor. I hear you almost stammering in that direction.
Yeah, well, labor, I said L because it was like landbouw, you know. It's not my portfolio.
No, thank you. In the process, we're still with this fiscal framework, and I was talking about certain principles. Now, remember, I'm trying to say that this Act is also guiding Parliament in what it can do in terms of its oversight function and not to stray onto the area of policy that's with the executive. So when one looks at those principles, they are broad enough for Parliament to have quite a lot of room for maneuvering in making its recommendations on the fiscal framework or on anything. But it is there, and it is trying to say to Parliament, don't take arbitrary decisions. And that will, of course, help with the whole international perception of South Africa's economy. But, Chair, once the fiscal framework has been done, the Act says the division of revenue bill and the appropriation bill can be referred to your committees on appropriations. Now, the division of revenue bill, as I said earlier, is the next step, and that will be finalized first, before any kind of amendments to the appropriation bill can be taken. I want to get into this appropriation bill phase, because we've just dealt with it, or we're still busy dealing with it in the National Assembly. And it basically involves the procedure of the Act. There involves referring it, and I'm looking now at the heading Budget Procedure. It's page 10. If one looks at the Act, page 14, section 10. The division of the appropriation will be referred to the Committee on Appropriations. And the individual budget votes, although the Act is not saying anything about it, we know that the PFMA says that each budget vote must be approved separately in the National Assembly. So the committees, like they did this year, will still each receive that specific budget vote of the department with its strategic plans and its medium-term expenditure framework, and its strategic priorities, et cetera, and then investigate and interrogate the budget. And it's at that point where this committee, for instance, can make recommendations to amend the budget of the department. And again, I will say, we want the history to that recommendation. We want to see that that was done previously. There was a recommendation previously looking forward. Then we want to see that the minister, when they introduced the budget, didn't do anything about that recommendation, and it is at that point where Parliament can come in and say, well, we want to give teeth to our oversight, we want to now amend the department's budget. There are no restrictions on this, except what I said earlier, it must comply with your division of revenue, it must comply or take into account your fiscal framework and those principles that are there. But the Act actually, Chair, gives two very interesting ways of affecting an amendment to the budget. And on the handout, that heading is specific amendment to the appropriation bill. It gives the committee the right or the power to recommend to the finance committee that a specific part of the budget must be allocated specifically. In other words, ring-fenced for a specific purpose.
The Act requires that such a recommendation must be to improve service delivery, must be connected to service delivery outputs. And the other thing, and this is even more critical mechanism, I would say, is a conditional appropriation. So there can be a recommendation to make a conditional appropriation, but such a report must then also set out what are those conditions that must be met before that money must be released. So in this instance, we're actually not only ring-fencing, we're really locking the gate. And those conditions are the key. And this key must come back to say, well, this is how we're going to get this money released. So those are two examples. I don't think it's limiting the portfolio committees to only making those kind of recommendations. But it gives us two specific recommendations for a committee to exercise its power. That recommendation will go to your finance committees. Now, we need to establish procedures in Parliament should the finance committee not be happy with that recommendation. You know, so we're going to have to have rules to resolve these issues. And what is going to happen, and I've never worked at that level, but what I'm aware of is that there's contestation about limited resources in this country between government departments. So the finance committee is going to sit there and see, but here's the portfolio committee on agriculture, they want a certain change in the budget. Portfolio committee on correctional service wants a certain change in the budget. And these competing claims might actually mirror what is happening at treasury level, where departments are fighting for different allocations. So one must be aware of these issues as well. One must be very aware of what is happening in the budget cycle within the treasury as well. So it's only once we have all that information we can really give effect to this act. But as I said, the act requires that Parliament's rules will then give a mechanism to resolve these competing claims from portfolio committees. But should that not be there, of course, the portfolio committee can still go to the House during the budget vote and make that recommendation to say that this is the vote which think should be passed. However, at that level, one will have to also resolve the conflict, because what we'll get from the finance committee is a report that contradicts those statements. And we don't, in my view, I don't think that should be at the House level. In South African Parliament, we usually resolve that in a mediation process outside the House. And we need rules for that. But that, I think, that budgetary review and recommendation report and then these specific allocation or conditional allocations, those are the important aspects for a portfolio committee to remember. Because that is where you get your projections and your teeth, your oversight recommendation and the implementation at that level. So the Act then goes on to look at other revenue bills, how that must be done, or revenue bills in general. It's not really relevant for this committee, but it's Committee of Finance must look at revenue bills, and then Section 11.3 sets out certain principles of tax collection which must be adhered to or taken into account when any amendment to a revenue bill is proposed. Well, I'll leave it at that. When I come to the National Adjustment Budget, because we're getting to where we started now. National Adjustments Budget is, of course, that budget in the middle of the financial year trying to appropriate money where our budgeting went wrong. Budgeting went wrong because there's been emergency expenditure, or there's been additional expenditure, or there's been bad planning. And then one must sometimes appropriate additional funds to authorize certain expenditure that has happened. Now, the adjustments budget, as I've heard, is introduced with the NTBPS. It's not the same, it's a difference. The adjustments budget itself consists of the adjustments appropriation bill. In terms of the Act, we also want a revised fiscal framework. If there is a revised fiscal framework, if we needed to borrow more money or there's suddenly a surplus. And the Act then also talks about a Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. So again, not that critical for this committee, but it certainly is a new development. Before any change to the Division of Revenue was basically affected by the Treasury by just changing the schedules to the Division of Revenue Bill. So they never introduced the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. And we will see how this plays itself out. Last year, there was no Division of Revenue Amendment Bill introduced. There was, again, changes made to the schedules.
Okay.
Chair, sorry. I think I wanted to check something on the appropriation bill. You were talking about the committee that can make recommendations to the finance committee with an intention to changing the budgetary allocations. Now, can that be done within the available resources, or they can still do it beyond the available resources? I'm looking at an instance of where the committee feels that there should be a change. But for an example, the minister comes back and say, I believe these are obligatory mandates that we have to do with the available budget. We would like to do 1, 2, 3, 4, but we may not have the budget to do 1, 2, 3, 4. Can the committee then go to the finance committee and say, we want to make the following changes in the budget without reducing some of these activities that maybe are obligatory to be done? I'm just checking on that one.
Chairperson, if you look on section 10, advocate, 10, 4 and 5, there's a lot of technicality there, which I think we need to be explained to.
So let's start off with the one that the DG is wishing to lobby Committee of Parliament on.
Thanks, Chair. With your permission, I'll just make a note of the time because I had till 10:45, but I think this will then go into that discussion time. The short answer, Honourable Chair, is yes. The committee can make a recommendation that there should be additional budget. The long answer is but. That but means that we cannot go into policy matters. So the budget sets out your policy priorities. Not all the policies in South Africa can always be fulfilled immediately. There's long-term and there's short-term priorities. But it sets out the budget is giving effect to the priorities of the policies of government. So if it fits into that, in other words, if there was a misappropriation in terms of what Parliament considers, Parliament and the Executive must agree that this is a budget priority in agriculture, but the money doesn't reflect that, then we can make an amendment to the budget, an upwards or a downwards amendment, I must say. I think we need to treat it similarly. But again, that must be founded on the history of the committee's work. We must look at our reports, oversight reports, your budgetary review and recommendation reports. How did we evaluate the service delivery of the department? And secondly, look at that NCDPS report. Because there also one will look at the spending priorities of government. And there, if Parliament failed to say anything to the Minister of Finance, it won't be, I would say, in accordance with the letter and spirit of this act to suddenly surprise the minister. We needed to inform him. We're always looking forward, as I said in the beginning, always looking at the medium-term expenditure. But there's nothing preventing a committee from making such a recommendation. But that, as you said, the lobbying, I mean, that kind of battle is what we can anticipate will happen, because, I mean, there's so much to do in this country, but there's not enough money for everyone to do it all in the same time. So we need to plan, stagger, prioritize. But certainly people do want, I mean, Parliament itself, we want more money to do certain things, and we don't get that always. So that's that. I don't know, DG, that's fine. The issue of explaining more about the appropriation bill, ma'am, what was that? Just section 10.5 that you wanted to explain.
Yes, before that, I forget, Jensen. Truly speaking, we're in a workshop here, and we need to understand issues if we don't understand them.
Yeah.
Firstly, do we really, as members of parliament, make any impact in the budget? Because to me, we're only given to say you approve this. We don't participate in the budget. And secondly, Advocate Junction, do ministers really take our views seriously if we raise them in the debate? Because they come up with a budget, they present their budget, we go and make noise then. Sometimes you see even the DGs, the minister, not jotting down issues that we are raising. Issues from the constituency offices, issues of serious concern. They are not there every day, but we are there every day. And we come and make that noise, and nobody takes us seriously. And I'm saying, are we really making a real oversight of the budget? Or are we just here to sort of rubber stamp? And also, if you look in Section 5, it's too technical. Can you please expatiate on that? Especially A, B, C, if you start from 5 A, B, C, D. It's too technical. I don't understand what it is saying there to me. Because it says... A recommendation to the House that a subdivision of a main division within the vote is appropriated conditionally must be accompanied by the response from the Minister and the affected Member of Parliament as the case requires. You know, I don't understand what are they saying there.
I did say earlier on, Members, that you see, the issue on the budget cycle touches on the very issues, Mama, that you are raising, in my opinion. It doesn't only begin when we are presented a budget. It has a whole cycle, to a point where it should even start from when we receive that annual report. Because we are literally told this is what happened, even before we get to that strat plan. So that we begin to say to ourselves, You did not use much of those resources that you allocated. Why? Because when you reach that stage of a strat plan, you see the same program, same plan, having not been attended to in the annual report. It's then that you begin to engage in the actual process of that budget cycle. It's us. Therefore, that must engage that process. I guess the overall essence of this whole act talks to the very issue of us as members of parliament having to take ourselves and be taken serious by the executive. Because now we're having a law. This is law. That we are expected to implement, or rather do, or rather exercise an oversight on. This law enjoins us to engage in these exercises of having to say, amend a budget. It's by law. It is stated here. I would imagine, I'm not too sure whether you had arrived at Section 10. I'm also avoiding a situation where we're going to be up and down on the issue. I don't know how far you were, because what I would propose you do, as you arrive at this point on the appropriation, you also give clarity to those issues, give content to these issues, so that we don't go forward and backwards, forward and backwards. I don't know where were you. You're on that same issue.
I was actually stopped.
Oh,
no, ma'am.
Oh, 10. Yeah, 10.
Okay,
yeah, no, Chair, I just took a step off the appropriation rule, but that is the critical part for the portfolio committee, as I indicated, and then the DG called me back just to understand a bit more of Section 10. What I said about Section 10 is that the appropriation bill is referred to the Committee on Appropriations. But the individual votes will still go to the portfolio committees to look at. And that's at that level, looking at the individual votes, looking at the department's strategic plans and estimates in the medium term, that the committee can then also, well, also keeping in mind what we said in our budgetary review and recommendation reports, and keeping in mind what SCOPA has said and what the House has adopted from SCOPA, that a committee can go out and propose amendments to the individual budget votes. I indicated to the DG that that vote can be moving around, moving items, line items, program items around, changing the money from one, the amount from one vote to another, but it can increase or decrease the total budget as well, which will be a more complex exercise. The questioner was asked now, and I'd like to get back just finally with the participatory aspect of the budget, ma'am, if you don't mind, I'll address that right at the end. Of the presentation. I have another 10 minutes or so, Chairperson, to finalize it. But what subsection 5, section 10 sub 5 is indicating or providing for is where a committee, this committee, by example, will advise the Committee on Appropriations of a conditional grant allocation. Now, the example I usually think of here is the budget we give to a current expenditure, specifically to human resources. There's sometimes quite a number of vacancies in the department. There's a certain percentage that one can accept as being reasonable or not, but should it be unreasonable, one can actually conditionally give that allocation to say, well, you first have to fill those vacancies before you can actually start getting this money. Now, I'm using it as an example. It might not be very pertinent because money for personnel expenditure is in any case quite strictly controlled by National Treasury. It's very difficult to use something like personnel expenditure and spend it on buying new furniture or taking an international trip. In fact, Treasury doesn't allow that. So usually that money stays within personnel expenditure. So I should find a better example. But all it is saying is let's take an international trip. There's usually a line item for those kind of issues in a department. And then looking at that saying, you cannot have this unless you show us something of value of last year's trips. Let's assume that we've looked at their annual report. They've indicated that they've taken a number of study trips abroad, but they haven't indicated the value for that. Maybe the Auditor General made a comment on it saying, we don't see the value in taking these trips. One can then go and ring fence this, conditionally appropriate this money, saying you can have it once you've showed us the value that you bring back to us. I mean, if one thinks of the South African tourism stand in Beijing on the Olympics there, which received so much negative publicity because of bad planning, there one can say, you can have that money again, but you need to assure us that you did the planning properly, that George Bush is not going to land there and take over the hotel, and you're not going to have any people at your stand. I think that's what happened, so it was not really of their fault, but that's the kind of thing we're looking at. And all that section, subsection 5 says is when you do it, first of all, you must indicate what conditions must be met. What that means is you must set the goalposts. What are those goalposts that must be met before that money can be released? Because we don't want a situation where the goalposts shift and you can never release that money. Remember, the money is for service delivery. So at the end, there's somebody that could be negatively affected if Parliament doesn't release that money. And Parliament does not want to actually do that. I mean, we don't want to impede service delivery because we're doing too vigorous oversight. We might then miss the point. What the Act also says is when you make such a recommendation, you must allow the Minister, before you recommend it to the House, you must engage the Minister. And the Minister must comment on it. They have 2 days to comment. If the minister wants to comment after the 2 days, I would argue that the committee can move forward and report to the House saying that we gave the minister the sufficient opportunity and the minister didn't respond. And then that, in any case, if the minister responds, that response must be included in the committee report so that the House can make that decision, can see what consultation happened between the committee and the minister on the specific one of conditional appropriation. So that's, yeah, that's them. The whole bill is technical, like I want to say. And therefore, and I'll get that, as well as the participatory element, when we get to the budget office. That's going to be a specialized unit that should address all these issues that committees have. It will be staffed by economists, I hope, and policy experts, but fundamentally economists, because Parliament is not there to formulate policy. We might analyze it, but we're not there to formulate it. So we really just need economists to say, how are we doing compared to other countries? And what is going to happen if you want to conditionally appropriate that or change that budget line? What does it mean for the medium term? You know, what's going to happen next year? If you increase the budget line 1 year, how does it relate to the estimates that is already been published by the minister the next year and the year thereafter? Are we going to have to increase it every year now? Do we have money to do that? That's the kind of aggregates that the budget office will have to help you with. So that's a very critical part of the work of a portfolio committee when it considers the appropriation bill. And it has the same role. I jumped a little bit over the revenue bill because it's not that important for this purpose, but when it comes to the adjustments budget, the same role must be played. There's now an adjustment to the budget of the department. As I say, usually it's emergency expenditure or unforeseen expenditure that has happened, and we need to give the department additional money. Sometimes there's additional money because of a year or two or three ago there was unauthorized expenditure, which has now been authorized in the meantime, and so we give that money for that as well. But once again, there, a committee can come up with a recommendation to say, we don't think you should give more money, or that emergency expenditure was not really an emergency expenditure. There you need some treasury advice. I mean, the whole issue of emergency expenditure in terms of the PFMA is a very difficult animal to put in a crop, if I can use something that's familiar to agriculture. That animal doesn't want to be defined, because whenever there's a shortage of time, everything becomes emergency expenditure, and that happens.
Let's give Mr. Dutoy just half a minute. My issue with this is the matter of non-compliance. I'm looking for, I don't see it in the Act that there's a sanction, there's jail terms or anything if somebody is in non-compliance with the law. And that is also the same that I found with the Structures and Systems Act at the municipal level, that it's against the law to do certain things, but there's no jail term or there's no sentence attached to it. If you commit murder, you know, there's a procedure and you know what's going to happen to you. But in this case, I don't see it. So how are you dealing with this? Because what's the use of a law and there's no sanction?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Now, this law sets out a procedure. It guides. It's something we have to get our heads around properly. I have a certain view on it. My view is that this Act is guiding Parliament. It sets certain time frames there. The time frames itself and the procedures itself, when one do not comply with them, and this will be Parliament not complying with them, or the Minister not complying with it.
Or the DG.
These non-compliance issues are certainly not criminal acts. You know, one must see that as there's a guide and maybe there's a good reason why one couldn't comply within a specific time frame. However, the issues of fiscal discipline, that Parliament cannot go out and make a certain recommendation to change the budget, that will so fundamentally change the fiscal position of the country that we're actually doing a policy change. That's a constitutional issue. It's once again, it's not criminal, but I would assume that the minister can take Parliament to court and the Parliament can strike down Parliament's actions. The court can say to Parliament, you have acted unlawfully, like it has done in the past, and say, well, therefore this action has no consequence and effect, and we have to redo the appropriation bill, for instance. But it's not a criminal aspect. What I think would be interesting to look at, because we have this Act, and I mentioned it earlier, the submission of timely submission of reports to Parliament in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. Once again, there's no criminal sanction attached to that. But in fact, there's no sanction attached to that at all.
And it is something I've read a bit about. The NGOs have been writing about it, that in the PFMA there's no enforcement mechanism to make sure Parliament gets the report on time. And Parliament will have to certainly have an action on that. But as the democracy matures, this is not my view again, as the democracy matures, people deal with it differently. At one point, one wants to jump up and down and say that there should be criminal sanctions, or one will jump up and down and say, what, there should be punishment here, there should be some administrative procedure, some kind of employment benefit that's taken away from you, or something like that. And further on, one can expect that there's more of a mature discussion between the executive and the legislature to say this is unacceptable, and that discussion actually holds water, because we respect the institutions that have grown as part of the country, and just get that respect without us thinking twice. Just the notion of Parliament, nowadays everybody knows more or less what a Parliament is and what it must do. 100 years ago that was not the case, 200 years ago not at all. So that's how I see it. It doesn't need sanctions to enforce these things, but compliance will be an issue, and how to ensure compliance, that's definitely an issue. And timely submissions of reports. Without the timely submissions of the reports, this act is going to be very difficult to implement, or it's going to create some challenges. So that discussion will have to take place. And as you said, other role players need to be involved here. It's the Auditor General, the local government organizations. I believe there's more than just one now in KwaZulu-Natal. And so on. So we need to sort these things out to make this a practical piece of legislation that gives the constitutional power to Parliament, which it was always intended to. So just to round off my presentation, I've spoken a bit about the adjustment budget. The other parts of the Act, there's one on other money bills, which are usually just levies, royalties that's imposed, that falls outside the budget. That's section 13. The Act allows for amendments by the Minister. That's also not so relevant for this purpose, or for today's purpose. But we saw that applied in 2009, after the elections. There was a budget introduced before the elections, and that budget bill, the appropriation bill, was revived by Parliament after the election. But there were new government departments in the new government. So then from the floor, the Minister of Finance raised the issue to say we need to change those schedules to the appropriation bill, just to correct it for the new department. And then that was done. There was no change in rands and cents. So it was what's called technical correction. Just to round off the functions of the advice functions, the research functions that this Act will require. In terms of Section 15 of the Act, should lie with the Budget Office, the Parliamentary Budget Office. Now, that's the section that was drafted to envisage a certain type of budget office, and the implementation is going through some growing pains, and there's probably going to be one or two amendments to Section 15. But in essence, it should stay the same, that there's a function that's needed in this Parliament, and that's expert analysis of the budget and of the estimates of the forward-looking budgets. And for that, we need that expert advice in the Budget Office. It is something we see in other parliaments with this kind of function. Canada is a good example. Other examples are not Commonwealth examples, really, but America has one. Uganda is a Commonwealth example, so that's there. Kenya as well. But they're also in the developing phase. But we are now part of this trend, if I can call it, of parliaments trying to assert, also Commonwealth parliaments, Westminster parliaments, trying to assert, or we've got some characteristics of Westminster, so trying to assert control over the budget process, because that is not a typical characteristic where parliaments can actually affect the budget process. So that's growing, and as I say, we're in the process of establishing that, but it'll take some refinement and some more work. Just to conclude on the issue of participation, I don't want to take too much time, but this is where you correctly characterize me as someone who then actually goes a bit off the mark, but it's very important in terms of this Act. This Act really underlying it is that Parliament participates effectively in the budget process now. Parliament can amend the budget. And when we look at the role of Parliament there, we have the two houses. NCOP represents provinces, NA represents the people. So in effect what we have, and it's been called, and the chair of Trade and Industry, Ms. Joanne Fobbs, who was also instrumental in drafting this bill, actually wrote a bit about this when she was in Gauteng legislature, about the participatory nature of the budget process, and that the budget of a country cannot be owned by the people, and the budget cannot be an effective tool for policy implementation unless the people feel that they own the budget. And therefore, you need to participate in the budget. And participation will then come either directly in the committee hearings or through the members of the National Assembly. So just to emphasize that it's very important to participate. Okay. Whether your participation will lead or will result in a change of the budget is a different story. Okay. And I think what is critical there is the responsiveness of the executive. If the executive do not respond to recommendations from Parliament, I think there's a constitutional problem. Because the constitution requires responsive government. As simple as that. So once there's participation through what's called your representatives or direct participation, and there's no response from executive, I think then, and this is what this act is also doing, then Parliament can act on it. But if there's a proper rational response, one must then carry on with the debate about what is right and what is wrong, what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. And I want to, maybe I should just leave it there, but I think it's an interesting discussion. You know, what's the nature of that participation and the response? And when can we actually say, okay, now we've spoken, now we want to see some action. And that's another story, but that's a political story in any case, so I'm going to leave it at that. In summary, we have the Act. It gives Parliament teeth. We're busy implementing it. There's a few growing pains. The Act itself is a long-term phased growth of Parliament into this procedure. But it's there. I hope it doesn't go away. And I think in the next few years, Parliament and the Executive and possibly the Judiciary will have to familiarize themselves with the procedures and then get used to this new phase in South Africa's democracy. For Parliament itself, the last point, and I want to actually address this to maybe my colleagues here, the administrators, is that we will have to manage information in Parliament very well. We need to get to the committee all the required documents in time that's coming from SCOPA, previous reports that have been adopted, advice coming from the budget office. All these things will have to be packaged for the committee so that they can do their work in the allocated time and to have a report that can actually be debated in the House. I would call it an organic implementation because there's no schedule set out in the Act when what must be done when. But last year's NTBPS was done in terms of this Act, except for the adjustments budget was not, because we didn't have that Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. Excuse me, but this year the budget was introduced, there was a fiscal framework, and the Minister introduced it as required in terms of this Act. So I would suggest that once, we unfortunately have the World Cup now, which will make things a bit tighter, but we must try and look at, we must look at the budgetary review and recommendation reports this year. Now I'm saying that from my perspective, the implementation team hasn't come up with a solid strategy or a document on it, but as we get past the appropriation bill phase, I mean immediately thereafter we actually having a recess for the World Cup, as we come back, I think the portfolio committee should look at what is expected of them in terms of Section 5 and implement Section 5 to come up with a complete assessment of the performance of that government department rather than various reports. It can still do various reports, but it must try and come up with that assessment and try and submit that to the House mid-October.
Is the budget office in place?
No, sir.
No.
It's
no.
Captain, Advocate James King spoke about organic implementation. What is organic implementation, Advocate?
It's like an organism that grows. It, you know, we all started as a single cell, and then we divide and divide and divide, and then certain cells start getting specialized functions, and you grow arms and legs, and it happens to all organisms, and that's what I mean. I mean, this parliament will now, we've grown since 94 into various, I mean, we were the Senate first, and there was a constitutional assembly, that has grown. Now, what will grow, we need to grow this budget office, and the functions of portfolio committees, and how the new relationships between itself, Standing Committee on Public Accounts, Committees on Finance and Appropriations, these relationships will have to grow as well. So it becomes institutionalized. So we don't think, so how must we do it? It must just happen. The staff, we who support you, must also be able to advise you, but this is flowing automatically there. We'll have to have IT systems that's developed to make this information flow as well.
And then second one, Chairperson, when you look on Section 8, it says when amending the fiscal framework, a money bill or taking any decision in terms of this Act, Parliament and its committee must ensure that the debt levels and the debt interest costs are reasonable. What is reasonable?
Thank you very much, Chair. Yeah, such measures had to come. I mean, firstly, as a constitutional obligation. Secondly, the way Parliament has been functioning. Now, Chair, there are certain things that need to be done immediately. For example, if portfolio committees want to monitor what is going on in those departments, I think a quarterly report is perhaps not the answer. You will require a bi-monthly report, and I'll tell you why. You have, for example, the budgetary cycle, the year, kicking in on the 1st of April. You need to know what the expenditure was before the MTBPS is tabled. Which means that if it's a quarterly one, then you're only going to have one report. So I would say that for the purposes of portfolio committees to function effectively and carry out that kind of oversight over the department's expenditure, you will have to do it at least every 2 months. Furthermore, Chair, this legislation was supposed to have kicked in the current financial year, before the start of the current financial year. Unfortunately, it did not. And we're already 2 months, almost 2 months, into the current financial year, and we still don't have a parliamentary budget office. Which has an extremely important role to play, prescribed by legislation. And I took note of Advocate Jenkins' comment that there may have to be some amendments to this particular clause, if I understood you correctly. But that those amendments may not be very major, they may be technical. Whatever the case may be, this office is extremely important. This office is supposed to be the central point, the powerhouse, from where this entire legislation and its impact and its effect has to be driven. The other issue, Chair, is, and I'm glad that the DG, the acting DG is here. I hope that the Hollywood stage is removed from this department soon. But in any case, Chair, what is extremely important is that the information flow from the departments, and it's not only this department, all departments, must be on the one hand factual as far as possible. It must reflect the true situation, and there must be a degree of speed. You cannot have information coming to you. I'll give you one example. I requested certain information from a particular department in March 2008. I got a response, a little four-line response,
in March 2010, 2 years. Now, how am I to make a contribution in terms of that department's performance and its budgetary flow as to how they're spending money? Then there's another problem that we've always experienced, and that is that especially when it comes to expenditure, for example, in agriculture like CASP and those sort of funds that are meant to assist people to develop agriculture, you would find that there is a lull from the start of the budgetary year up to a point where when it comes to 2 or 3 months before the end of the financial year, you suddenly find a surge in expenditure. That sort of thing needs to be very closely monitored by the department to see that there is a constant flow in the expenditure. So, Chairperson, what I'm asking is, in setting up the Parliamentary Budget Office, without which and without the expertise that it is supposed to provide, members of Parliament, the portfolio committees of Parliament, who have a severe lack of research capacity, will not be able to perform their tasks as it should be performed. I mean, I see that as one of the major impediments in seeing to it that the legislation is given effect and that it is effectively implemented. Without the warm bodies, you are not going to be able to do that. And whether there's any indication as to the setting up of this office and the employment of the capacity that is required. Because somewhere along the line it also says here, if you look at page 22 of the Act, right at the top, it says here, the Parliamentary Budget Office may undertake research on request by the Houses, other committees or members of Parliament on matters related to the budget and other money bills subject to capacity. Now, it is provided for in the legislation. And this is a beautiful escape clause. All they'll do is tell you, if we request information or any research assistance, we'll tell you, listen, sorry, we don't have the capacity. Because it's provided for yet.
In law.
Says, in law, subject to capacity. So I would suggest, Advocate, that there is something also that needs to look at if you people are looking at amendments to the legislation. But overall, Chair, the flow of honest, credible information with integrity, is extremely vital. That cannot be overemphasized. Finally, Chair, in budget debates, once you speak in a budget debate, you expect that at least a couple of weeks down the line, the department and the minister, or both, would come back to you and tell you that you raised this particular issue. And this is what we have to respond to you with regard to that particular issue. Over here, what happens, Chair, is the minutes of the committee will be filed away. Your speech will appear in Hansard. I don't think the department or people who must do implementation will ever read that speech. Doesn't happen. So we've got to brush those things up and sharpen. Thank you.
When this issue was being looked into about capacity of Parliament and specifically of the budget office, the critical point there always has been, and it continues to be, whether Parliament will be able to live up to the expectation of this piece of legislation, with its intended very, very noble intentions. Not only the budget office, Mr. Abram, but equally committees of parliament themselves. Capacitation at that level. Because you would be expected to do a prompt analysis of the budget, both in terms of the content and also in terms of the figures themselves, and the comparative analysis being done. You know, previous budgets, and also looking into the total budget of a country. Now those are the issues that would equally be expected to look into almost promptly as we engage in this exercise. Maybe your comment on that one, Mrs. Pilusi Masani.
Thank you. Chairperson, I don't know even if this is going to be, if an act, it will be implemented. But I don't know, Chairperson, because every financial year you'll get the Auditor General recommendations, COPA recommendations, the committee recommendations to the department. And it will continue like that. Other recommendations, the department will never implement them. They will just be there. I'm not sure what will happen now because of this act. But my worry is that always there will be recommendations from all those structures which I've already mentioned, but the department they don't implement. And another one is that when do we debate the budget before, because always we debate after, and like our budget, the agriculture budget, we can see that the budget is not enough. But to say we pass this budget, seeing that this budget is not enough, even next year it will be the same. Even the other year it will be the same. Now what is the use? And I think maybe if they engage us before, maybe we can make a difference. But after, always after, no difference. It will just like stay like that until. Thank you.
Members, we now have a responsibility. Before this act, we were not having teeth to bite. Now, Trevor mentioned the other day, Minister for Finance at the time, that we are now having this money pool that we need to implement in the form of a law this time around when this budget was passed. I mean, with this, what you call, law was passed. The onus is on us now to give meaning, to give credence to this. So, departments, therefore, will literally be expecting us to say, yes, we're passing, no, we are amending, and so on and so forth. So that's now a responsibility for us. I guess the critical issue, again, there, will be about capacity for us to be able to be spot on some of these issues so that we're able to really give meaning, serious meaning, to whatever we want to do. So that we have now a responsibility ourselves. Advocate Duncan?
No, thank you for that, Chair. Let me just deal with a question of Section 8.5, which are the principles for fiscal discipline, which somehow
hinged on the concept of reasonableness. And the Act doesn't really go forward and explain what reasonableness is. And I think Parliament must give meaning to that through the advice it gets from the Budget Office and through its political mandates that it receives from the people. So one person's reasonableness will be a budget surplus. Another person's reasonableness will be a budget deficit. We need to look at our context, our economic development. We need to look at what's necessary for the country. We need to look at the Constitution fundamentally, which envisages equality, which envisages social justice, which has enforceable socio-economic rights. What I'm saying now is not a political statement. It's there. The courts have said it. It's been written about. That's what we need to look at. It makes very interesting reading when one sees what is happening in other countries. That's why it's a nice time to actually study this Act. As I mentioned, the debt levels for Greece, which is unreasonable, 114 or 120% of their gross domestic product. When one looks at Canada has a rule against budget deficits. They're actually suffering from surpluses of billions every year, which is a problem. Because, I mean, taxpayers' money, billions of Canadian dollars taxpayers' money that's sitting in a government bank account, not being spent. I mean, that's, if you're a Canadian, that's your money that you've paid. And you could have gone on a holiday to South Africa to watch the World Cup. So that's an issue there. It's a totally different issue than what we have here. Canada aspires to bring their debt level down to 25% of the gross domestic product. Our debt level for the first time has risen above 25% last year. Just from what I read in the budget documents tabled by the Minister of Finance. And we at 30%, and we'll stay more or less there. And for us, that's reasonable. So one must try and get a sense of what's best for this country. And you can compare yourself to other African countries and other countries in South America and in Asia. There's a name for it, Brazil, India. All kinds of names, and a group of 50, etc. But that has to be done, and that brings us to the second part of the questions that I received of the Parliamentary Budget Office. Now, this Parliamentary Budget Office is a powerful tool. It will cost quite a lot of money, and there are definitely political opinions about how this office must look like. I'm working for Parliament as a legal advisor, and I was part of drafting of this clause and this act. But I can say that there was a lot of political intentions in creating that budget office. But what I want to do, if I can do something for this Parliament, is actually to get the message across that we have to have an institution-wide concept, an institution-wide idea of what we want as Parliament from our budget office. And we need to be careful. We need to hurry, but we need to be careful to get that there. We have a very good example in Canada. Canada passed their Accountability Act, I mentioned it earlier, in 2006. Which requires the creation of a parliamentary budget officer, just that person. They took a good 2 years to find the correct person to fill that position. 1 year down the line, they had huge regrets about that person. And they didn't have regrets because he's doing bad work. They had regrets because his work was too good. He saw himself similar to our act. Parliamentary budget officer in Canada must provide independent advice. But the budget officer saw himself as independent because of that. For no fault of his own, he got his legal opinions, he characterized, conceptualize his position. He had staff working under him, and he started releasing reports about the state of the economy and the estimates in the future, which contradicted what the National Treasury was saying. And he was appointed by the Conservative Party, who took over as a majority party in the Canadian Parliament. In fact, they had a minority party ruling Parliament at the time, the Liberals, and as you know, there was a huge corruption scandal with the Liberals. Conservatives took over also on the strength that they will have a budget office. They implemented the budget office 2-3 years down the line. They had regrets because during the election period the budget officer, in doing his independent work, released reports of the estimates of the war in Afghanistan, which contradicted what the government was saying. And it looked strange for the average voter. Now, I don't see that as a fundamental problem. I just see it that you need to really establish your accountability lines and your reporting lines. How do you publish your reports? What protocols do you use? I mean, as you're aware of, even in our parliament, you can't just go out and publish anything and everything. When we dealt with the arms deal case, those documents were quarantined in a special room in parliament. Members could go there and read through certain members, and there was reports on it for reasons that I'm not questioning at all, but it's just the way we deal with certain information, how we release that information, how we manage information, what is sensitive, what is not sensitive. Some of it is truly national security, others are more political, but it must be dealt with at that level. As an administrator, it's very difficult it's very risky to just run around throwing everything out of the cot and saying, well, this information must go out there. You know? This is information that's required from a specific parliamentarian, for instance. Should that information be published, or should it just go to that parliamentarian? I mean, the money paying for that information is the taxpayer's money. Those kind of questions are there. So the issue of accountability is fundamental when we look at the parliamentary budget officer. Issue of reporting and how that structure fits into parliament's administration or not. Who appoints that budget officer? Is there a performance agreement with that budget officer? Then we get to the functions of that budget officer. If we look at section 15, those functions are quite specific. Some of them are very proactive. Some of them are more reactive. How do we capture those into key performance indicators to put in a performance agreement? To get to your key performance indicators, we need to have some kind of outcome that we strive for. Before we can have an outcome, we must have an idea what impact we want to make with our budget office. In other words, we need a strategic vision for the budget office. Of course, it must be aligned to our constitutional mandate and to the vision of Parliament, which was accepted by Parliament. So within that context, as I said, my wish would be that Parliament formulates a vision, a concept for its budget office, and creates it around that, rather than taking the act and appointing someone there and say, let's just hope everything works out and we don't get into the situation Canada got into. Because the budget officer lost some credibility. In my view, and what I'm reading, he regained it, but there were issues of his budget, and there was a public spat between what's their head of research there, which is at the level of deputy minister, and the budget officer himself, about the budget of the office, and the not giving the budget that the budget officer wanted was interpreted by him, of course, as cutting his wings, and he cannot then serve the people and serve Parliament, etc. And it became quite a nasty spat. And there's no need to replicate the mistakes. I think much more noble to replicate the good results that one can get. So I think within that context, one must look at our budget office and say, well, it will take some time to get the right person there. Before we can get the right person there, we need to get the right office, the right concept. What is it that we want with this budget office? And through the implementation team, that is, I think, one of the critical areas which has been addressed, to look at this budget office and to say, what is it that Parliament wants? What do we want to do with our budget office? How can it help the institution to fulfill its mandate that it gets from the Constitution? And that must happen. You know, I will think that that should be a priority for the immediate future. The issue then, which Honourable Abram raised, and it's very interesting, it was raised in Canada as well. How do you, with your capacity, start servicing other portfolio committees? I mean, this Act is quite clear where their priority functions lie. And it is indeed a matter of capacity where the portfolio committees can be advised. So that is then a thing where we one will have to support the budget officer to get that capacity. And to also accept that when there is a judgment saying, well, we do not have capacity, that is made in good faith and impartially, like the Constitution requires. I would certainly argue from a lawyer's perspective, myself included, we're public servants. We might work for Parliament, we might not be falling under the Public Service Act, like my colleagues, but the critical issue of, I don't know what it's in section 197 of the Constitution, sets out the principles of public service, and you have to be impartial. So that's there, and one must accept that from the budget officer. I would argue that the budget officer will also be a public servant, section 195. Public administration must be development orientated. See, that needs to be built into the concept that we have of a budget officer. It won't assist South Africa if a budget officer constantly advises the committees to cut expenditure so that we can have a budget surplus. Services must be provided impartially, fairly, equitably, and without bias. You know, that's from the core principles of public service. So, yeah, let me rest it there. I hope there's more questions. If not, it was a privilege to be here and to assist the committee. I hope I did. And if there are further questions, my details are there. I'm at your service. It's not a problem. If I don't have capacity, one of my colleagues will have the capacity. But that's my wish for the budget office in any case. And I think from a political side, there is movement there. There's discussions with the presiding officers. Mr. Bapela is driving the process with the chairpersons of the other committees as well as the chairpersons of the review of the rules committees. So one must see where it goes on. It cannot go on forever, but we certainly, Honourable Chair, in your absence, I explained a bit why it's not an overnight thing to get the budget office there, that you need the right person. And before you get the right person, we need to have the right idea, the right concept, the right vision for the budget office. And my analysis of the situation at the moment is we need to develop that vision. We need to say, what is this budget office for Parliament? Where does it want to take us? And then to fill warm bodies to that vision. Looking at the Act to say what's wrong with the Act in terms of accountability and so on, we can deal with later. We can then say, let's amend the Act to make sure that this person reports to the office of the Secretary or to the office of the Speaker and the Chairperson or to a committee in Parliament, however we want to do that. At the moment, there are some lines drawn, but it was never fully modeled, and we might need to just twist it a bit. From my colleagues and I that read through it, we found that there are certain issues, you know, because we have a lot of political involvement with setting up the office. It's very difficult to get proper accountability if the budget officer can turn around and say, but you told me that we should have so many people here. Now you're saying we're wasting money. You know, it's not me who made that decision. It was us. Now you want to knock me over, wrap me over the knuckle. So, but in any case, the idea should be that Parliament gets an idea of what it wants. What's the function of this budget office? And then build it up from there.
Thanks, Advocate Franklin. Members, we are obviously engaged in a process, not in an event. In a process, I'm sure other members have been engaged in this similar, you know, briefing with Sogoni, who is the chair of Appropriation Committee, and also with Mufumadi, who is chair of the Standing Committee on Finance, and of course also with himself, Advocate Jenkins. So it doesn't end here. It's an ongoing process. As mentioned, it is highly technical. Given all of that, we are at the end going to be expected to implement this law. I asked two specific, in my view, pertinent questions. When will we be expected to implement the law, and whether the budget office does exist? Those talk to each other, those two questions. They talk invariably on implementation. As I said, this is a process we are starting as a committee. It's a very important exercise that we're going to be engaged in as part of our oversight. Because when we engage in such, you know, budget amendments or otherwise, we should have been able to understand what the law says as to how we do it when we implement the law, when we do what is expected of us in terms of our oversight work, amending or otherwise of the law, or rather of the budget, sorry. Mr. Abram, you still wanted to...
Just something that I want to point out. You see, Chair, under section 15.4, it says there must be a cooperative relationship between the Parliamentary Budget Office and other research structures in Parliament. Now, it's very specific. It says there must be. But how do you implement that must be? If other research structures in Parliament refuse to cooperate, there's nothing here which says what can be done to enforce their cooperation. And just another last one. Also under section 15, clause 16. In carrying out the duties and functions of the Parliamentary Budget Office, the director may procure the services of experts or consultants or organizations by contract. Now this is one of the things that has been giving us, I think I went grey by this. Because once you have this opening, this Parliamentary Budget Office and the director can turn around and tell us, yeah, but the law empowers me. I can contract this work out to an organization. I can contract it out to a consultant. I can contract it out to an expert. It is wide open for possible misuse and misdemeanors. I mean, human beings being what they are, can abuse this kind of clause. So I don't know, and as I say, I mean, if other research structures in Parliament say that we've got enough work, by Jove, we can't cooperate with you, we don't have the time, what mechanism is there to enforce that cooperation? So I think these are some of the things in the law that will have to be taken care of. Because, you see, Chair, the trouble is, the law says, nobody has the right to lynch me. But the law cannot absolutely deliver me from being lynched. And this is the kind of thing that one sees here. As the law says that there will be cooperation, there must be cooperation. How do you enforce it? And where you allow for contracts, you are allowing for consultants, and it's way open for abuse. We've seen that happening. You'll find a guy resigning from a municipality where he had a fixed salary. And he now works for that municipality as a consultant, and he earns 4 or 5 times more than what he earned when he was a full-time employee. So these things are open for exploitation. I'm just pointing out over the years what we've learned. Thank you, Chair.
Well, on the other hand, the contrary could equally be the case, wherein those consultants could be your best of people, and those contracts could be the best of the contracts, in presence of what you want to achieve at the end of the day. Maybe let's be open-minded on some of these issues, members. So that's the point that I wanted to raise. While they are equally important, the issues are raising, Mr. Abram, there could be, you know, a case that is, you know, contrary to that. I know we have an experience as a country, but equally, I'm one of those optimists, you know, that always, you know, look at things in India who still a holistic sense. But as I said, point taken and appreciated. Members, I think we had come to, I think the points have been noted, Advocate Jenkins. the we have arrived at a point where now we need to say to ourselves, we have started a process. It is an ongoing process. We have to consult with our own selves and consultants and legal, you know, fundis that we work with as political parties, and further engage precisely on matters that relate to our work as to how best, given all the constraints, there's no office as yet and so on and so forth, how best can we really take this process forward. I think that that's how and where we should pause for now on the issues. I'm not saying end, but pause. Okay, we should thank you, Advocate Jenkins, on that note. And maybe just before we wrap up, members, two or three housekeeping matters. We don't mind, even if we talk, you being here. The first one, members, is that, of course, the letter is going to be distributed, DG, it comes from the Minister, on Female Producer of the Year, 2010. Competition was reviewed by coordinators on 21st October and aligned to respond to food production, recognized value chain activities, trade and export, as well as participation to the full spectrum of the AGI for historical disadvantage. Therefore, the campaign will seek to recognize female producers of the year in the following categories that I mentioned. The nominations will be facilitated by coordinators and extension officers in the provinces. In addition, the industry and unions will also facilitate the nomination of the farm worker category. Additional details will be workshopped with your provincial officials before end of March 2010. Based on the model of the previous, provinces will continue taking turns to host annually. This year's will be in the Eastern Cape, and all inquiries and so on. This calls on us to participate in this process through our own provincial departments where we are working in our own constituent areas. This is female farm, female producer of the year 2010. There's no specific mentioning of the date wherein this is expected to take place. I don't know whether DG wants to fill us in on that one. But the letter is going to be distributed to members for information, and also there are some few other areas, categories, that members might wish to relate with. The second issue relates to the program. Today we had the workshop. We were not able to get ourselves going out to Upington on the Rift Valley Fever oversight visit. The House Chair preferred that we rather invite the Agriculture and Health Department, which we have accordingly done. That is going to be next week on the 18th of May. On the 25th of May, that day falls on Africa Day. So we were prohibited from engaging in any activity on that day. Our last day here will be the 1st of June, but these are all going to be circulated to members. 1st of June, basically that day will be taking us on board with a whole range of administrative issues, both from the consideration of the adoption of the agreements we were meant to have dealt with on Friday,
there is an adoption of the report on the oversight visit and also minutes adoption. There are other outstanding issues. We were also not able to deal with the matter related to the stock theft. The police pleaded with us that because of the World Cup tournament, that they are very, very preoccupied with that program. So they really pleaded with us that if we could have that after the World Cup. So that's what is happening. Mama?
Chairperson, I'm a bit worried. We have spent days coming up with a program of the committee. And on that day, on the 18th, our agreement was that we are going to be briefed on what breeders' rights on that particular day. And now we are no longer consulting one another. We are coming up with a discussion. To me, my understanding is that on the Rift Valley diseased whatever, there's nothing for us as a committee to do, because we had a discussion with the minister. And the main thing that should be done by the Department of Agriculture and Health is for them to see to it that they spray on the mosquitoes. Because I'm told this disease is spread by mosquitoes. And if really they don't do that, for us to come and discuss here, I don't see any impact. And instead of us diverting from the actual program that we agreed on, Chairperson, to say, I think next time, because some of us, you know, when we say we are going to discuss about this, we do our own research so that we can be able to participate in the discussion. But with the Rift Valley disease, it has to do with mosquitoes. It has to do with the two departments to see to it that they stop the disease by spraying, by doing what, by destroying the carcasses and all that. But if they are not doing that, Chairperson, what will our discussion be? What will we benefit out of the discussion? And what will we benefit from the information that we will get from the people from the province? Meanwhile, the two departments are not doing anything. If at all, they are not. Thank you.
We attempted twice to get a briefing document from the Department on Plant Breeders Policy. We were disappointed not to have had those. And having not received any documents, we then had to act. If you remember, 2 or 3 weeks or so ago, at that point, having not received anything from the department, we then opted for, especially given the situation of that Upington incident of that abattoir. But most importantly, equally, here we are confronted with a Rift Valley fever. That experience there in Upington speaks to an abattoir who told communities out there, if you eat meat being refrigerated, the meat, the fever, rather the disease, the infection, is done away with. That's what prompted us from attempting to go there physically outside of the committee. But the house chair saw it differently. Now, the other issue, critical issue, I've also been engaging with the FIFA LOC people on this very issue. Because also with the incident that took place in Ostron here, what became very clear is that this was spreading unabated. In other words, the diseases themselves. So the intention, therefore, equally here, has so much to do with both the food safety and food security. So that when the department is here, together with the health people,
we are able as a committee and also the nation to really sound the bells on a need on these two issues, safety and security of our foodstuffs. What measures are we getting? How far are we? The other day I was reading the statistics. Whether reading the statistics is enough from hearing also what they have to say is something else. For us to be able to get as part of our oversight work, because we have that responsibility when it comes to safety of food and also security of food. Visitors are going to be safe here in terms of food that they eat. We have enough security in terms of food availability. These are the issues that are also linked up with on this matter that you know, we thought it is important and urgent. Mr. Abram?
Chair, you see, at one of the briefings where I think the Department of Health was present, there was an official from the Department of Agriculture. And I made the emphatic statement that the Department of Agriculture had let us down. When the disease broke out, Death Valley fever, I think for the edification of everybody, it is a disease which is carried by mosquitoes. Now, luckily, we are in winter now, so the mosquito population is at least in hibernation. But the fact of the matter is that the department failed on the ground as well as through the media to warn people. I mean, the poor people in the rural areas, if there is a carcass of an animal, which fed the animal open and used the meat. They're poor. People had to be warned that eating any dead animal, there's a risk of this particular disease, that it can be transferred to a human being via an animal. And so, Chairperson, we have at the moment, I don't know what the latest statistic, but I think it's somewhere in the order of about 47, 48 people that have been hospitalized and about 18, 19 people that have died. The problem is, Chair, that that has been something that is being conducted by the Department of Health because they report on deaths and hospitalization and things like that. When our department did not do its job is to warn people and to inform people. Even after we had had a discussion on this, when the disease broke out, and we had told that particular official, all we know is that yes, the department has bought so many doses of vaccines. That's all we know. But to warn people, Chair, the department did not carry it out. And that is the aspect that is extremely worrisome. With regard to the police being not available because of the World Cup, the police has a specific unit that's supposed to be working with stock theft. Are they now telling us that because of FIFA World Cup, even the stock theft people are going to be working on the FIFA World Cup security? And then I understand that there are so many different security firms that have been contracted to provide security. And that therefore those policemen cannot come here to come and talk about stock theft, which is costing South African citizens approximately 350 million rand a year. So, Chair, I find that totally unacceptable. And I don't think the committee agrees. I think we should tell you, Chair, that you should tell the South African Police Service that it is extremely disappointing that they are not available to meet with this committee on stock theft when they've already had meetings here in Parliament on stock theft with other entities. And if there is tomorrow, Chair, a major problem in the country and you need the police, are they going to tell you that because of FIFA World Cup, which is only taking place from the 11th of next month, that they are unavailable to see us. Cannot work that way, Chair. That is Parliament, Chair. And Parliament has the right, any committee of Parliament has the right to call upon any public entity to appear before it if it has some or other issue to discuss with those people. And I feel very disappointed, Chair, that on issues like this they let us down. Does this mean that when the public complains, and we get these complaints in our constituency, and when we go to the police station to report a rape, when this happens, when that happens, we are not taken notice of? People have other things to do. So, Chair, please, we cannot accept this. It is not an excuse, and it is unacceptable to accept such an excuse. I personally don't go along with it. Sorry, Chair, but this kind of thing is not acceptable.
Chairperson, can I make a follow-up on what you said on the plant breeder rights?
Mm-hmm.
You said, Chairperson, thank you very much for being so honest to us on this issue of plant breeder rights. The DG is here. I'm saying I'm very much happy for the person to be honest to us on this issue of plant breeders' rights. Plant breeders' rights. And also the chairperson, the DGs here. Chairperson, earlier on I said, are we making an impact on oversight? I was referring to some of the issues that you raised. There's no way that the Department of Agriculture cannot provide information if you want information, Chairperson. We need to buy the Department of Agriculture by implementing certain issues that they will serve them right. For instance, when it comes to budget, just be quiet, because they also don't respond to our requests. We also not respond to their requests. Chairperson, this government will never be 100% on service delivery because of such attitudes. We seem to protect them too much. We seem to agree on issues that protect them, Chairperson. Right now, Honorable Bosman, in his debate, he spoke about the veterinarians who have been shifted, moved, and we're quiet about this. How can we be able to deal with this value while the veterinarians department has been shifted from their responsibility and given what they did not go to school for? How can that happen? Now we want to blame people on the ground about this risk value. Meanwhile, the problem is in the department. And we're not explained why those veterinarians were moved. And you know what? The pigeon holes are telling us different stories. The pigeon holes about these veterinarians. And we're talking about it. The eggs are the eggs were in the pigeon holes. We picked up the eggs. We read the eggs. And we know the reasons of these veterinarians. But we don't have that platform saying the eggs are saying this. Is it the truth? But we thought maybe after hearing it from Dr. Bosman, we'll get a response. This morning, Dr. Bosman, in his laptop, when opening his laptop, there are more eggs there. And he said to me, did you receive the eggs? I said, I haven't opened my laptop. And I will go and receive the eggs there. And we are protecting those eggs not to crack, not to break, 10%. Meanwhile, things are not going right. DG, I'm a straightforward person, and I'm saying, please make sure that your people respect our decisions, your people respect our requests, because we'll come to a push where we'll just say, no, enough is enough. In Malawi, 3 years back, they said, we're not going to deal with the budget if they're not responding. I went to Nigeria. Parliament confiscated tractors from the Department of Agriculture. Because those tractors and tractways were not correctly used, and they took them, and they were rotting there in Parliament. I think something must be done to put pressure on the department, Chairperson. Because there's no way that you can write them a letter or request them to come and brief us on plant breeders, right, and they don't give information. Something must be done, Chairperson. Thank you.
In fact, even on the planned Freedom policy, here is a department that sought a slot for briefings. But when we wanted information, it didn't come through. Anyway, that's the detail. The issues related to the department's operational dynamics. And when we deal with matters as briefing from the department on the Rift Valley fever, these are issues that we have a platform to deal with. Because we'll literally be having a platform to ask questions as to who is responsible within the department. Now, those are the issues that we have a right to engage on. Now, members, that's the other issue that Mr. Abram was raising about stock theft. The 25th falls on a Tuesday, to a point where I'm saying to myself whether we cannot take one of those days in that week, whether it's on a Wednesday, wherein we engage with, I'm not sure what day were we supposed to have the stock test. It was meant to be the 25th. But let's look into that matter of having to find somebody, because they were actually talking more about, you know, the commissioner of police and whoever else would have been expected to be around. If we are saying a specific person dealing with that matter and whoever else.